Welcome back. I imagine that wasn't quite enough time. Yeah. While it's fresh with you, I have a question about, I'd like to reflect together with you about what it was like to be the chaplain for the other person when they were talking about their experiences of loss and grief. And I'm going to use some of these questions that I had on the table yesterday that I'd like to call transition questions. So would somebody be willing to say, was there something surprising in your interaction as the chaplain with the other person? What surprised you? I'm going to give you the microphone, which I believe you helped repair, so thank you.
One surprise that came up for me and kind of reminded me that we're like a kind of death-denying society was that I found it difficult to like maintain eye contact and continue to be present when like the person I was sitting with like had like strong feelings. And I was like, that's me, like I'm uncomfortable. And I just assumed that everybody wants to be very private with their feelings, but like that's not what I'm there for. Like, so yeah. That was a difficulty for me and a shortcoming that I will have to figure out.
I think it takes practice. But it is surprising how resonant we can be like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's that kind of resonance and response, it's not a problem. It's just part of the process.
As for me, I was discussing with Sri as he was telling me his stories and his experience. I noticed that I was taking mental notes of his strengths, you know, like one of his strengths is his spiritual maturity, and that gives me something to work with, you know, knowing just kind of assessing how he is. In a way, it's hard to not relate. So there are some, at some point where I can relate with him, but of course I was just listening. So that's what I noticed.
Thank you. And that can be a challenge. Yeah, so it also answers the question, what's challenging about, you know, listening to somebody else? Our parallel, you know. What was inspiring? Was there anything inspiring about being the chaplain to somebody talking about their loss and grief? Or opening? If you could say, describe that for the rest of us, that'd be great. With our friend, the microphone. It's on.
Thank you. I think what's challenging is that when you really open to the person's grief that you're witnessing, you are afraid that you're going to drown.
And what would you drown in?
Overwhelming sadness. I think what's inspiring is that you don't that you know that something actually arises when you let go, and you there's some kind of strength or clarity that feels like it is coming out of nowhere, which is coming out of everywhere. Why we unconditional sitting practice is at the kind of core of what we do.
It gives us the capacity to meet that experience.
Yeah.
Sometimes mourners to me seem like the Olympic, what's the sport where they lift weights? Olympic weightlifters.
Good job.
All right. And people are so strong. It's awesome. Like, they're in the middle of it, and it doesn't feel that way to them. Or if I see people a few times, you know, like, people are strong. They, you know, it's amazing. Thank you. What has to soften if you're with somebody who's grieving? Or did anybody feel a softening or a deepening? Can you describe that for us, or how you might think about that? I saw some head nods. I'll assume somebody's going to get the microphone. No visual pressure. Oh, come on. Somebody's got to pick up that microphone. Thank you. Talk about softening or deepening for us.
What softened for me was my my intellect, my kind of sense of boundaries, but it was really cognition, and just feeling my heart is what it was. Mm.
What was the thinking activity at the beginning that softened later?
Oh, am I going to understand? Oh, wait a minute. At the beginning? Yeah. Am I going to understand this? Can I be present for this? Questions about, like, me and, like, what's going to happen next?
Mm-hmm. And that
melted away with listening, with feeling, being present.
Cool.
I think for me what softens is this perception of separateness, and that I feel like I share the loss with the person. We share the loss together.
Mm-hmm.
And what deepens is an understanding of this being a very common experience.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is going to have it. It's not special. My experience of loss isn't special. My partner's isn't. That this is just part of life.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the circumstances are different, the emotive response may not be expressed at all or the same way. But the feelings are exactly the same.
Yeah. Thank you. There's a saying a grief shared is halved, and a grief kept secret is doubled. So giving people the opportunity to share their grief through conversation, through ritual, through acknowledgement, through condolences, through showing up at a ceremony, helps them have their grief. I love that. It may not be true for everybody, but it's a really sweet notion. Thank you for your reflections from your dyads. Is there anything else from your conversations that's would be good to say out loud or raise a particular question? Conrad, cool.
Do you want me to use the mic?
I do.
Okay. This is my stage voice.
You know who listens to every class, too, is Vanessa. She listens to all the recordings. And I think Gil might, too, since he's not here. So.
Yeah. Intimacy. That grief and opening up to it and just being in that space, having someone hold it for us and offer in turn is deeply intimate. In a way, when we ride kind of the superficial layers of our daily life, we never get to with someone. Mm-hmm. And then you get to see their soft underbelly and what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you really see someone.
Yeah, so. It's true. I have a thought about that. With mourners, I'm pretty careful about physical proximity and touch because the intimacy can be misunderstood. And I'm going to do a presentation in April on erotic transference and what to do around sexuality in spiritual care. But particularly with mourners, things can collapse pretty quickly so that somebody's crying on your shoulder and then an arm goes around and then you can, you know. So just a little, I'm kind of, because that emotional intimacy can wander a little bit like water outside a river or like, so, you know. Yeah, it is, you know, and understandably, you know, without blame. Thank you for bringing that up, Alan.
I was just thinking about. I had the pleasure of talking to a partner who I know somewhat and who happens to be very well spoken, deeply intelligent, and very pleasurable to talk to. But if I've learned nothing else from my other practice, is that you have to expect the unexpected, and that no creature is more complex than a human being, and no matter what would be expected to come in based on my specialty or whatever, it may not be what I see. So being able to put the tools I'm learning in the proper place and use them appropriately becomes important.
Yes.
For example, the meditative practice is very important because, for example, I told a story about a musician who said, learn the rules and then forget them, so you can use them at the appropriate time. So when the unexpected happens, to have those aside and really be able to give myself to the moment and just use what's needed, right, how it's needed.
That's right. Frank Ossoseski used to talk about a toolbox, you know. But he said, if you bring the toolbox in the room with you, somebody's going to trip over it. So go in without the toolbox, metaphorically. See what's needed, and then go out and get the one tool that you need. You know, like, so I like that. And then Picasso was trained classically to paint, to draw, you know. And then he went out and riffed, you know what I mean? There is, some of this is kind of tools, rote, you know, open your ears, shut your mouth, track, watch the space between you as well as just the other person and yourself. Think about the context, like, you know, these could all be these things that rile around in this spiritual care toolbox. But that's the process of training. And I think some of the mistakes I've made around grief is to underestimate the sideways expression of grief. You know, so like, I'm like, okay, we're going to talk about your loss and really get into it. No. People are going to go around the side door, break in, go into the basement, and turn the water on and leave. You know, like, you know, like, they're going to get really mad at authorities. You know? They're going to find fault. You know? They're going to pick fights. So, which is, so some of the readiness is to, again, to be like, okay, there it is, grief in its distressing disguise, you know. I'm going to sue you, you know, for what's happened. Microphone to Conrad again.
You touched on something that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. For some people, where grief gets deeply embodied, but they can't name it, it's like a psychosomatic response. We're like, I have all this pain in my gut or my teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something you would point out to them? Like, does that feel like grief to you, or how do you sure. address that? Going into the basement, turning on the water, and lighting everything on fire at the same time.
So let me just talk about the six dimensions of grief and expression, because the physical one, there are some classical physical expressions. Fatigue or sleeplessness or restlessness or lethargy. The sudden urge to take up running. Or I can't run right now. I've run every other day my whole life and I can't even, you know. I went out in my running togs and got on the path and I ran 10 feet and I just stopped. So, physically, people crave certain foods or have like dry mouth. Yeah. Or what they've enjoyed, they can't, you know, or they even lose their sense of taste. Okay. Did you have a thought about the physical grief?
Yeah, I just wanted cool. to throw out for Conrad. Definitely worth thinking about, but I would tread very lightly in bringing it up because people do not want to be told their pain isn't real. It's triggering.
From a pain doctor, that's probably a lot of data goes into that point of view. Yeah, yeah. It's a great point, Alan.
Well, Alan, with that, what about saying, does it feel like it could be part of grief? The pain is still real.
I mean, yeah. Treading lightly.
Yeah.
Sugar-coated. And maybe framed as a question, not as a...
declaration.
Yeah.
This is a great discussion, so it just reminded me of some other quote from one of the spiritual teachers, Tara Brach. She said in one of this training sessions, she said that the pain is real, and it or the grief may be real, but some of these imaginations may not be true. Like, you know, as they go through this grief and suffering, they will experience the pain. As caregivers, spiritual caregivers, we don't deny their experience, but whatever they are imagining may not always be true.
Right. A lot of wisdom in the room. I don't know why I'm sitting in this chair all of a sudden.
This is a really important topic for me, and I really appreciate the comment that it's like being someone who's in pain all the time and having, you know, the experience of a lot of that. I think the best way to approach it is to say, is to not know, So to, as the practitioner or the coach or the doctor or whatever, just to not know, you know, you don't know someone's somaticizing. Mm-hmm. You don't know where their pain is coming from, and you can't know, and they can't know. So just holding space for, you know, that might just be a pinched nerve. It might not be psychological. It might be coincidental that they have a pinched nerve and they're grieving. And you can't ever know.
And if somebody said, I'm sleepless, I'd say, why don't you go see your doctor? You know, I wouldn't say, don't worry about it, you know.
Yeah.
But I also say, well, that's also an expression of loss and grief. You know, it's fairly common, you know, to help people stay close to their experience. So I want, my idea with grief is to help people stay with it, you know, and not turn away from it. You know? So sometimes information, like saying that's common, can help people accept it a little bit more and note it more and be like, and a little bit not too stressed about it. Like, oh, someone said to me, you know, so-and-so died and I spent my whole summer putting a new roof on the garage. And I thought, and I said, that seems like an appropriate activity when you're grieving, to rip things apart and throw them away and cut wood and climb ladders and sweat it out on the roof, you know, and bang shit. Pardon my French. You know, I didn't say to the person, you might want to put a new roof on your garage as an expression of your grief.
Well, yeah, you know. It's so important to get that line, because what you said is so helpful to say, okay, this might be grief, but there is an assumption to say, oh, that's grief.
And if they say no, it's not, I'd be like, oh, okay, it's not. You know, like I don't berate the point, you know.
Yeah. But the other thing is to note the timeline of the symptoms.
Timelines,
so
may yeah.
Have
Right, right. And also the roof might have been really in bad shape, so why not? You know, it's not like it was a brand new roof they ripped off. But so that's also the physicality of grief, is that people take on physical projects, you know. And there's even research on the differences around, oh gosh, I feel nervous saying this, the continuum of gender, you know, that a more masculine approach is more physical, and that a more feminine approach tends to be more creative or expressive. And the male's a little more cognitive. Now, I'm nervous around that just because of the cultural conversation about gender and such. But nonetheless, if within each of us there is both, and maybe a predominance, you know, it might, you know, I'm like, oh, you're an athlete? Of course you ran 3 triathlons in the last year, you know, in honor of your loss and change. You know, that makes total sense to me. You know, like, you know, so that's the physical. And then there's also mental, which is related to this. So people have difficulty with concentration. I used to do the crossword every Sunday, you know, and I can't do it right now. I keep losing my keys. I'm driving the same route to work and I make a wrong turn. I can't read a book right now. You know, people's power of concentration. Also, I've been with people and they say, okay, you're going to go down the hall and turn left. And I watch them go down the hall and turn right. Their stress level, you know, they're like trying to find room 112 in the hospital. They're trying to find, and I finally learned, like, I'm going to walk with them until they turn left. You know, because again, people cognitively, there's a bit of a fogginess. Or, you know, they're in graduate school and all of a sudden they stop going to class and they're not enthused about their dissertation, you know, like, so. And this happened during the pandemic, I think. You know, people started consuming a lot of distraction because the mental capacities were shifted and we were all trying to wrap our minds around, stay home for 3 weeks? What are you kidding? You know, like, okay, and we'll be done in 3 weeks. You know, like, so mentally. And then also imagination. So, and this lapses a bit to spiritual expression. So people have a sense that the person is present. or that they had a visit. And this is into the spiritual expression. You know, spiritually, I feel like they're still here, you know. Or I'm receiving messages. You know. So those are some spirits. This is the third category. So we had physical, mental, now spiritual is. Other spiritual expressions are to create a space in the home or in the office where there's a photo or an object. My friend I mentioned earlier, whose ex-husband, you know, she put on some jewelry that he gave her. You know, I think this is both, and so this is behavioral too, but I think spiritually for her, even emotionally, like to put something on is an expression. You know, instead of putting on black, perhaps. Spiritually, people have a lot of questions, or gain a lot of clarity. You know, spiritually, people start going back to something they used to do before. They drifted away from a practice. They all of a sudden feel a connection to a particular saint or teaching. You know, they say, I'm reading this poem, or this phrase keeps coming to my mind, you know. And there's a million phrases that people keep in their minds, you know. Or they're really deeply diving into the teaching of fill in the blank. You know. The volume is turned up, yeah. The one piece of advice I got once around spiritual practice is to double down instead of lightening up, you know. This is not the time to kind of take your foot off the pedal of your practice. Let your grief be more, bring you more passion for practice. You know, and if you're going to let things go, you know, it's so useful, other things to let go of them, like to cancel a trip is, you know, probably maybe not a bad idea. To stop going to your Sangha once a week is maybe not a good idea. Even if you sit in the back and leave early. You know. So that was once told to me. Don't let your spiritual practice fade. It's hard to get it back. Another is behaviors. So people will say, I have to take a new route to work now. I can't drive by. Or I want to go back to where it happened. I want to go see. I want to put flowers at that intersection. Or I'm going to, people go to graveyards or go or sit on a particular bench or start donating all their money or start writing to people they have lost touch with. There's all kinds of or the behaviors drop off. You know, like I'm not going to my quilting bee right now. I'm canceling a trip. These are all expressions. I always forget the last one. There's six, this much I know. Social, relational. So I'm not going to parties, or I'm going to lots of parties. I want to go out and be with strangers. I want to be in a crowd. I don't want to be in a crowd. I only want to be with these kinds of people. You know, I only want to be in silence. I can't stop talking, you know. Social. And related to this is family. So there's also expressions of grief in families. And one thing I've noticed is there's, for some people, there is an implicit or explicit expectation that you grieve with your family and then you grieve in the same way. And family members will even tell each other, it's okay to grieve in the family, but, you know, we're keeping it inside, you know. And we're all doing it the same, you know. And that's unlikely. So sometimes I'll in terms of an education piece, say to people, not everybody grieves in the same way, even in the same family. And it sounds like you're getting pressure from a sibling or a parent or a child to be like so-and-so, and so I want to encourage you to understand your unique expression, and you could even tell them to back off, but at least for yourself, you know, to... And or I'll say, you know, it's so natural to compare, you know. And siblings, you know, really compare themselves to each other, you know. And they might want to feel at least like you're together in grieving, even if your expression is different. So this person may also, it may not be that you're not crying like they are, but they may feel a little bit like there's a disconnect between you, you know. And the person may say, actually there is, and I like it that way, you know, like almost feel like, I need to work a little bit more through my grief before I can really, you know, and or other people feel like we have to do this together. So it gets complicated, and I don't try to sort it out as much as I may say to people, it's complicated, you know. And there's the family grief, there's individual grief. If you can maybe be patient and give people room and benefit of the doubt or forgiveness, you know. Nobody's really at their best right now. You know, it's a helpful thing to say. I hardly ever see anybody at their best when we're in this area, territory, you know. I actually see people at their worst, you know. I saw a family have a fist fight right once over when somebody died. People are at their worst. So let's have an accurate expectation. Nobody's at their best. We're all upside down. So, time, and the one thing when people say, is anything going to help? You know, or what, I need something to hold on to, you know. There is one thing I say, but you have to be very careful about when and how you say it. Don't say it as a platitude or as a there. But at some point, I do say to people, it won't always be like this. FYI, you know, this will change. And that's a very hopeful thought for a lot of people. I'm also not promising it won't get worse. This may just be the beginning. You know. And I can also speak to my own experience with a lot of types of suffering, and we've seen this through, you know, for example, meditation practice. You know, I think it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And then all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, I'm not even in any pain anymore. And I'm thinking, what happened? You know, and all I can come down to is like, it changed. You know? So I do say to people sometimes, it won't always be like this. And that's a comforting for most people. And I feel like I can say it, and it's true, because I've also been through journeys with people when time has passed, you know, and I rarely see anybody in the same place with it if I see them again. So I feel like, I think that's really true. When I broke my ankle, I think somebody said to me, we're going to get you better. You're going to get better. And I love that, you know. It's such a sweet, simple, you know. It's a form of, it won't always be like this. Yeah. But with grief, I don't say to people, it'll get better. That may not be true. So those are the six dimensions, almost like facets of a diamond. Yeah. I see you holding the microphone, cradling it.
I am ready. If we have time for a question.
Absolutely.
What about individuals or other family members who wanted to die with the death? Any words about that situation? Any words for them?
That seems like a whole other hell realm. Adjacent.
Yes.
With a little gerbil tunnel between the two. I think it is, you know, I don't want to be here without them. That's how deep my grief is. My grief is so deep that I want to die too. So I would just see it as like volume, you know, of their grief. It's extreme. It's a little scary, you know. But that's this poem, you know, like put the stars away. Put them, like roll up the woods and pour out the ocean. I mean, that's extreme language, you know. Stop the sun. Like, that's, I want to die too. I wish I could have died for them. I want to kill the person who killed them. Yeah. I'm furious they died in the operating room, and I hope I don't see that surgeon soon because I'm worried I'm going to throttle him. Take away the stars, pour out the ocean, roll up the woods, turn off the sun. That's how I would think about and understand that expression, which also means I don't need to have an answer. Besides, that sounds like a lot of grief. Sounds like you're really in the middle of it right now. And I appreciate that you're letting me sit with you. Remember the rich Inuyami Rimen? When we go to fix people, we see life as broken. So if I hear that as a brokenness, then I think I have to fix it. So nothing's broken. There's nothing to fix. But it takes practice, you know. So that little... She's also said when we see life as whole, we serve. We don't fix, we serve. So that person's still whole, and I'm serving them by accompanying them, giving them some information, giving them my time, affirming their unique expression. So they're still whole. I'm serving them. I'm not... And then the other third one is when we help people, we see the world as weak, or see people as weak. So you're not weak, so I don't need to help you, you know. And some people really want and do feel weak and want to be treated as if they're weak. And sometimes I get into that, but then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm working too hard here. And that's part of who they are or how they present themselves. And they're used to being helped. And there's some real practical help. And a couple of you have had mentor meetings when I've said to you, I'm giving you specific instruction and advice right now, but because you asked for it, it's a little, I overstep, I am a little too helpful, but then they're spinning. So I'm kind of like, okay, here's the edge, and maybe if we bump into the edge, you can stop. So it's a fine line, you know. It's not that I never help, but I'm very careful. I don't let that toolbox trip me, you know. Oh, well, if you just give it some time, you know, if I just have these platitudes, when I was talking to my best friend. So we have a lot in common. Her name's Mary Ellen, and... she said she has one sister that she really doesn't like that's really suffering, and she said, guess what my sister said to me, you know, about Bill's death. And I knew exactly. I said, let me guess. She told you that he's in a better place. People say this to each other. They really do. They believe it. Particularly in hospitals, the nurses, there's a little bit of this culture of that's a good thing to say to people. Of course, I would just, you know. And some people might find that comforting, but as a chaplain, I don't say that. Because it's a little too neat and tidy. And then the other one is another one of my, that I don't really like, is the, well, when one door shuts, another door opens. These things might be true, but they're not, they keep people away from their suffering a little bit. And my dharmology is that part of it is the only way out is through. So to turn into suffering, and this is some of the what we do with, for example, meditation practice, the turning towards suffering is a way to, you could say, what is compassion? It's turning towards suffering. You know, there's a lot in the Dharma around this, but for me, and you guys are writing your dharmology papers in a couple months, so in my top five would be kind of the only way out is through. So in my work with people, I don't do things to take them away or to have them transcend. Other chaplains do, you know. They're like, I got to go in there and give them some hope. That's their theology, you know. But, you know, and I think it's congruent with Buddhism to kind of stick with the difficulty, having some trust that, but it's titrated, you know, like I don't add, you know. I don't, so going towards or at least seeing, you know, and even, and it takes practice. As you said, Sage, it's very stimulating, you know, the parallel or even the concern, you know, but with practice, you know, I've seen that that is mostly true, you know. So, yeah, they're in a better place, and when one door closes and one opens, just...
They're together now.
They die together.
I can't tell you how many people I know who are good friends of mine who are not religious in any way. I know they don't even believe in heaven and hell and God. And they said, well, your mom and dad are together now. I just wanted to scream right. So many times. Like, how do you know that?
So, you know, there is kind of this...
Right.
I think around mourners, other people are nervous. And some of this is related to emotional contagion, or one grief can kind of wake up another. So your grief can raise my dead, you know, to use that crude expression from earlier. And so, and that's natural and understandable, you know, like I've got mine all tucked in and I don't want yours unraveling mine. And that is where I think, particularly with providers who are around a lot of grief and loss, they have to kind of keep it. And so these words sometimes are a way to kind of set a boundary, you know. Unfortunately, it's not always useful or caring towards the person they've said it to, but I see like, oh yeah, they can't go there. So they're saying this to, in some ways say, I see you, but keep it over there. I don't, you know, keep your mess over there. And I don't blame them. Like I say this to be realistic and it's understandable, you know. And so I say to myself, that person doesn't have the time, the capacity, the skill, but they're caring, and this is, it's also cultural. Like, I thought, this is kind of what is said in this facility, you know, or whatever, you know. But I do judge it, too. I have a bias. I don't intervene and say, don't say that ever again in my presence. That's bad care. But I think But then I think it's understandable, you know. So, and also I might meet somebody that somebody just said that too, and they're mad. They tell me they're in a better place. I'm like, okay, I guess that's where we're starting. Okay, let's go there, you know. Somebody told me by now I'd be done, you know. I'm going to look at the time, because I feel like this is a territory we could go on, but we need a break. I'm doing pretty good. We got 4 minutes according to the schedule. Things are popping, though, I can see. You know, and I also don't want to keep talking. So let me say a couple more things. Downstairs, there's a book about grief that is my favorite book about companioning people through grief. If you need a textbook, that's a good one.
Which one is it?
It's called Companioning the Bereaved, and it's just on the table. Beauty, poetry, movement, color, generosity, water, heat are all balms, B-A-L-M, for grief. So, there are poems that are about entering difficulty, and yet they are transcendent. One of the ones I love is Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. So, yeah. And I would say with grief, I think I had another class, stood up next to somebody and I faced them and then we turned side by side. Did we do that here? Okay, time for a demonstration. Would you stand? And would you stand? Great. And face each other? Okay. Great. Now, comrade, if you would come alongside them and face the same direction. See the difference? So for grief in particular, this is the position, the manifestation, the model. When you go back to the other position, comrade, go back where you were before. This is a little bit more like the treatment model. And believe me, when I have somebody, when I went in with my broken ankle and the doctor walked in, I wanted to be like this. I didn't want to be side by side strolling with that person. You know, I was like, treat me now, you know. But it has its limits. So just an idea. Thank you both. Yeah, I'll leave you with that. And we're going to also downstairs. So there's a lot to grief. There'll be resources. I would say if you want to take this up deliberately, you can reflect on your own grief and it will become a gift that you can share with others. And then understanding grief, a little context for grief is really helpful. And then there are religious rites and rituals around grief and loss, which we haven't even dipped into yet. But I want to share one from Japan with you that has been taken up at the San Francisco Zen Center that I have brought an example of and is on the table downstairs. So in Japan, there is a particular bodhisattva named Jizo, J-I-Z-O, who is identified as the companion for those who have died and for mourners. And one image of Jizo is that he journeys with people to the next life. And Jizo is a protector to children who die, who need extra protection in the journey. And if you travel in Japan, you even see Jizo statues at crossroads in the forest. And at temples, there are Jizo statues where people place children's objects and even clothing on the statues when there's a loss of a child. So at Japanese temples, there's often rituals and expressions of child loss. This then came to San Francisco Zen Center and has become a ritual that I actually lead several times a year with other people in person and virtually. And we do a grief ritual that is nonverbal for the most part, that is about making an object as an expression and then having a ceremony. So I, on the table downstairs, have left some little things about Jizo, a book about Jizo, and some Jizo statues for you to kind of just, maybe you know Jizo already, or just to see what, and there, to Jizo there's a bit of a childlike quality even in all of it, so that's another way to think about grief, is to bring the simplicity of a child, you know, yeah. So you can go downstairs and meet Jizo Bodhisattva. Okay.
Oh, I was just going to say 10 out of 10 Jizo ceremony.
Is that a rating?
I'm sorry?
Is that a rating?
Yeah, I was encouraging microphone. People to go.
Hello. To recap, I was saying that the Jizo, like ceremony and activity was wonderful and was very helpful to me as I went through some, through a lot of grief, and I would recommend it to anyone. So,
thank you for the shining endorsement.
Yeah, 5 stars on Yelp.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly share that in the Hindu culture also, they have something similar.
Well,
and when my dad passed away, we had this 13-day ceremony, and one of the last day, the priest was carrying some of these belongings, and as though he was going to heaven, carrying deposit in the heaven. That was the ritual they did. So,
like, could you give me an example of what kind of belonging, like a suitcase?
It could be like an ashes. Okay. Yeah, things like that. So,
thank you. Yeah, lovely. Okay, we're going to stop. Oh.
Would you see a Jizo in a cemetery?
Yes. Okay. So in temples, the statues are markers. Jizo's also the bodhisattva for firefighters.
Why?
Protection.
Because he hangs out in hell.
He spends time in the hell realms of fire. And once upon a time, there were even firefighter jackets with some imagery related to Jizo, which were, by the way, several layers of fabric stitched together, soaked with water. And now they're collectible. They're like antiques, textiles. Anyways, never mind. Let's take a break. Seriously. If we're talking about sewing and fabric, then we're done for. Because I love to sew and I love fabric.
And they were indigo and highly valuable.
They are. Yeah, they're. Yes, exactly. So we need an extra 5 minutes for the break, but I think we'll be okay. Yeah. Think we'll be okay? Come back in 15 minutes. And we're going to bookend this and then go into the religious history assignments. Okay? If you feel grief and something coming up, this arbitrary ending doesn't mean anything. So don't be surprised if now or later you do have some grief. It's coming because we've kind of invited it by being together in this way. Yeah.